Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David James Gonzalez, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Yu Tokunaga, author of Transborder Los Angeles, An Unknown Trans-Pacific History of Japanese-Mexican Relations, published by the University of California Press in 2022. Yu Tokunaga received his PhD in history from the University of Southern California in 2018. Currently, he is Associate Professor of History at the Graduate School of Global Environmental Studies with a joint appointment at the Graduate School of Human and Environmental Studies at Kyoto University in Japan. Hello, Yu, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Definitely. And is it okay if I call you Toku?
Yeah, definitely. Sorry.
Since I'm more used to using that nickname, if you will, or portion of your last name.
Yeah.
So for the audience, Toku and I were at graduate school together. We overlapped during our time at the University of Southern California. So I somewhat saw a little bit how this project developed, but we'll get to that in a moment. I'm wondering if you can just begin, Toku, by telling us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I have to explain why I go by Toku, because my
Please.
First name, Yu, is a little confusing in English, because everybody is basically Yu in English. So I go by Toku from my family name. Okay. By the way, for my background, I was born in Japan in 1982, and I grew up in Kyoto, where I work now. Since I was a high school student, I have been interested in exploring how people with different ethno-racial backgrounds could live together. And before entering a college, I entered a Kyoto University. I'm going to talk about that later. I learned some of the socioeconomic difficulties faced by immigrant groups and their descendants in Japan, such as people of Korean descent, generally known as Zainichi Koreans, and Japanese Peruvians. Since I was ethnically part of the majority in the modern sense, it was shocking to know that there were such injustice and inequality in Japan. So I thought it was very important for me to think how to build a more inclusive society, although I was not sure what I would do in the future at that time. When I was a high school student, I was curious about other things I didn't know. So when I was 17, I went to Costa Rica and lived there for 1 year as an exchange student. Out of pure curiosity, I simply wanted to go somewhere I knew nothing about. And in Japan, Central America is not much known, so that's why I wanted to go there. And I learned Spanish and got a better understanding of Latin American culture in Costa Rica. Certainly, I enjoyed living with my host family and friends and drinking flavorful Costa Rican coffee. It's actually, Costa Rican coffee is really good. I recommend that everyone should try. And I know in America, people drink a lot of coffee and you know, you have tasted it. But anyway, I love Costa Rican coffee. Anyway, And also, when it comes to immigration history, I experienced what it was like to be a minority person from Asia as well in Costa Rica. So my experiences in both Japan and Costa Rica made me even more interested in exploring how people with different ethno-racial backgrounds could live together. So this curiosity led me to study U.S. history in my undergraduate and graduate programs. And when I was a junior student at Kyoto University, I studied at UC Riverside for 1 year, again, as an exchange student, and took many ethnic studies classes. And after graduating from Kyoto University, I was not sure if I what I would do in my future yet. So academia was one of my options, but I was not sure totally. So I got a job as a newspaper reporter because I wanted to do that job too. And I worked as a reporter for 4 years in Japan. And I reported many different things, incidents and accidents, I covered many issues. But I tried to report the current situation of immigrants in Japan as well. And while reporting such things in Japan, I became increasingly interested in having expertise in immigration history. And I wanted to study U.S. immigration history again and more because it tells a lot about both Asians and Latinos in an immigrant society. Then I finally decided to enter graduate school to get a PhD in history. And I went to USC and met DJ there, and it was great. And what is interesting is that when I was in Costa Rica, I didn't think I would use Spanish for my work in the future. I just wanted to do something new. So, I happened to learn Spanish, I would say. And also, Spanish was my first foreign language. I didn't speak English well when I was a high school student, so I learned Spanish. But eventually, I wrote my dissertation and my book by using a lot of Spanish language sources. So I think it was a little interesting twist in my life. And fortunately, as you said, I now have a position in Kyoto, my hometown, and I teach U.S. immigration history at Kyoto University. So this is a short summary of my background.
Thanks, Toku. I'll tell our audience that your Spanish is better than mine. So
I don't know. I'm still trying to, study Spanish because.
Well, Toku, why don't you tell us about how the book, the project developed, and particularly you started to mention how Spanish, came in handy, but, this is not only a transnational study, it's also, you conduct research in three different languages. So can you talk about, how that develops also?
Okay, thank you. So as I said, the fundamental reason why I wanted to do this research is I was interested in exploring how people of different ethno-racial backgrounds could live together, right? So, but there is a longer story about how my dissertation developed. The dissertation became my book later. So when I applied to USC, my initial plan was to focus on Japanese-Mexican labor conflict in the 1970s. There was a well-known conflict between the United Farm Workers and the Nisei Farmers League. I thought it was a good idea to use my language skills as both Japanese and Spanish. And at that time, I could handle English as well. So, but after I started to study at USC, I realized that there was much more to know about Japanese-Mexican relations in Los Angeles before World War II. And then 2000, I think it was in 2013, I had a chance to attend an event about the history of Japanese in the Dominguez Hills area in Los Angeles. And there I learned that the California State University at Dominguez Hills had a lot of primary sources related to local and local land companies and Japanese farmers who leased land from such companies. So I decided to do research on this specific area right away, and I was hoping to find evidence that would show the relations between Japanese and Mexicans. Then I found that many lands leased by Japanese were taken over by Mexicans after Japanese internment. So I wrote a paper for a research seminar at the USC, and this piece became chapter 6 of my book. And chapter 5 is about kind of similar topic, but the relationship between the Japanese internment and the Bracero program, because I wanted to know the relations between Mexican immigrant experience and the Japanese immigrant experience. And also at USC, I took classes together with DJ and classes on Mexican-American history or Mexican-American studies by reading many books and articles on Mexican immigration, immigrants' history in Los Angeles. Again, I learned that Mexicans and Japanese had serious labor conflicts in the 1930s. But no study had examined these interethnic conflicts from the perspective of Japanese government and Japanese immigrants. So I started to do tri-national and trilingual research in Japan, Mexico, and the United States. I was hoping to find something that demonstrates the mechanism of interethnic relations and the transpacific dimension of these local conflicts that took place in Los Angeles. And what is really fascinating is that you can find historical documents related to Mexicans in Los Angeles at the Japanese archives, not in the U.S. And also, likewise, you can find documents related to Japanese in Los Angeles at the Mexican archives. So, or I guess many listeners of this podcast conversation are interested in Latino studies, but I would say you can find documents for your research on the Latina studies topic, not only in the United States, but also in some other countries like Japan. So even if you focus on a specific immigrant group, not only Latinos or other groups of people in the U.S., historical documents are scattered around the world. So that's one of the fascinating thing to do historical research. And my research on Japanese-Mexican labor conflicts became important parts, very important parts of my dissertation, and eventually chapter 3 and 4 of my book. So this is how my dissertation developed and became my book. Yes.
Great, Toku. And on that point that you bring up, how you can find these documentary records scattered, you know, throughout these different countries, is that particularly because of the type of records they are, and that you're using consulate records and you're using newspapers at, you know, foreign language newspapers like the Rafushin Po, which is the Japanese language newspaper in Los Angeles, or La Opinion, right, Mexican language newspaper. Mexican language, Spanish language newspaper. It's coming towards the end of the day here. So your day's just starting, mine's just ending. So my brain's starting to shut down. But is that kind of because of that nature of those records?
I would say it's a nature of the topics I focused on, because our labor conflicts are not about local issues in Los Angeles, because, you know, or the reason why, for example, the reason why I could find documents related to Japanese-Mexican conflicts in Los Angeles at a Japanese archive is because the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan was checking the communist activities around the world, because the Japanese government wanted to prevent communism from spreading in Japan. So they were very, they were paying close attention to what is happening in other countries. So Japanese-Mexican conflicts in Los Angeles can be understood or framed as a history of inter-ethnic relations in Los Angeles. But if you take a transnational perspective or international perspective, that is much beyond that. So, or the Japanese government recorded meticulously about how Mexican labor movements affected the Japanese population in the Los Angeles. So that's why I could find those documents. And at the same time, when I was looking at documents in Japan, the Japanese government was aware of how the Japanese-Mexican conflict affected Japanese in Mexico. So then I try to look at related documents, and I look at, for example, La Opinion, and how I wanted to see how La Opinion reported the conflict and whether they reported about the reaction of Japanese in Mexico to the conflict in Los Angeles. So this is how I connected different kinds of sources scattered around the world, and eventually put everything together in each chapter or a book. Yes,
that's definitely fascinating, and I think that the documentary record speaks to the type of unique place that 19th or early 20th century Los Angeles, particularly, the agricultural parts of Los Angeles, it was, right? And you describe this, that is, LA farmland, between, 1900 and 1930, all the way up until World War II, really, the beginning of World War II, as a trans-Pacific workplace. Can you expand on that? Explain what you mean by that?
Okay. Trans-Pacific workplace is a concept that means a contested site in which the local relations among Mexicans, Japanese, and white Americans operated within the context of increasingly precarious international relations around the Pacific Ocean. So I regard Los Angeles farmland as a trans-Pacific workplace in my book, and this is related to the reason why I titled my book Transborder Los Angeles. It's a very close concept. I titled my book Transborder Los Angeles because in Los Angeles farmland, as I said, I regard Los Angeles farmland as a trans-Pacific workplace. There, Japanese, Mexicans, and white Americans together formed inter-ethnic relations beyond racial and class boundaries in both local and transnational contexts. And especially after the United States prohibited the Japanese immigration in 1924, Mexican farm workers provided indispensable labor for Japanese tenant farmers in agriculture, because Japanese tenant farmers were not able to expect that the newly coming Japanese were providing labor for their farms, because Japanese immigration was prohibited. So Mexicans-Japanese relations deepened, especially after 1924. And in the more urban areas, Japanese merchants and doctors had catered to Mexican residents and supported, interestingly, supported the publication of La Opinión. La Opinión is, as you know, a major Mexican immigrant newspaper in Los Angeles. They they supported the publication of L'Opinion as advertisers since the paper's founding in 1926. So I really enjoyed looking at early editions of L'Opinion, looking at and finding many ads placed by Japanese merchants and doctors, and they say, "Se habla español," that kind of thing. We speak Spanish, so you know, just to appealing to Mexican residents in there. And another interesting twist is L'Opinion was financially partly supported by Japanese merchants and doctors, and many other non-Japanese advertisers as well. But interestingly, this L'Opinion became played a very important role in supporting Mexican strikers in the 1930s. So, and things are very interconnected, and also sometimes they are supporting each other. Sometimes they are fighting each other in the case of conflicts. But I think I explained clearly how their relations developed in farmland. Yep.
Great. Great. You mentioned the interactions between white landowners, Japanese tenant farmers, Mexican farm workers, in Los Angeles agriculture. Some of our listeners may be aware that Los Angeles had many other ethnic and racial groups, but as you explain and describe, when it comes to farmland, it's really the interaction of these three groups, right? White landowners, and we understand white landowners is an expansive category as whiteness is developing and expanding in the early 20th century, but you label this a triracial hierarchy, which is a fascinating term that again I think is pretty unique. At least to Los Angeles, with these three groups, it reading your book made me, since I'm currently in the process of my own research on Orange County, it made me think about Orange County and how there is not this triracial hierarchy in agriculture in Orange County. Orange County is really a kind of binary system between whites and Mexicans. So, can you talk about this triracial hierarchy in LA agriculture? Kind of how it worked and where Mexicans and Japanese were positioned within it.
Okay, so our triracial hierarchy is an important concept, and also I would say it's the reality in the past. And Japanese farmers were not able to lease lands because of the California alien land law in 1913 and 1920. But many Japanese continued to lease land from white landowners under the name of their U.S.-born children. So basically, there was a tacit tacit consensus between white landowners and Japanese tenant farmers for Japanese farmers to keep leasing land in Los Angeles. But as I said, after the United States prohibited, it's another discriminatory immigration policy, but the U.S. Prohibited Japanese immigration in 1924. So Japanese needed to hire another source of labor. And Mexicans were not restricted by the Immigration Act of 1924. So although there are new system to control the immigration, including Mexicans, but not numerically prohibited, Mexicans were not could enter the United States. So they became the major source of farm workers for Japanese tenant farmers. So that created what I called the triracial hierarchy. And what is interesting is that, when Mexicans are suffered or faced economic difficulty because their wage was low, they went on strike against farmers. But farmers were leasing land from white landowners. So they, Japanese farmers themselves are in a difficult situation as well. But the entire system is basically owned by white agribusiness. But when it comes to strikes, those immigrant groups fought each other. And white agribusiness could stay a little bit away from the conflict, but hoping that Japanese farmers would win in the conflict. So that is system is interesting. Everyone in that system was trying to work hard to get a better life, and the Japanese tenant farmers, Mexican workers, and maybe white landowners in their own sense. But it shows the entire system of white agribusiness, and you could say it's a racial it's part of a racial capitalism. But at the same time, I wanted to look at the agency of those immigrants, even though they were under the influence of this big dominant capitalist and racial racist in structure. But still, those immigrants were trying to do their best, and sometimes they try to nurture mutual understanding each other and try to understand, for example, Japanese farmers try to understand the situation of Mexicans, and also Mexicans also try to talk with somebody who they knew better and to negotiate together. For example, Mexican consul or immigrant labor union leader had some close relationship with certain parts of Japanese farmers and Japanese leaders. So I wanted to show those details, the agency of immigrants, at the same time, the dominant structure of capitalist agriculture in Los Angeles. Yep.
Certainly. I think one of the fascinating things for me to learn was that as part of this triracial hierarchy, that it actually expands across borders, right? You describe the formation of the trans-border ethnic Japanese community in Mexicali, Baja California, Mexico, right? As a result of the racist and exclusionary 1924 Immigration Act. Can you talk more about that? Tie that, let's bring that into the system, because that is just a fascinating story. I mean, I was very much aware of the history of the ethnic of Chinese, right? And particularly in that region in Mexicali, I have family there on both sides of our family. But this story actually was a little new, and you provide a lot more detail. So tell us, how is it, and why is it that there's the formation of a Japanese community in Mexicali?
Okay, so my book looks at the Immigration Act of 1924 that prohibited Japanese immigration altogether from a transnational perspective. The Immigration Act of 1924 is Japanese exclusion, but that was that kind of resulted in Japanese inclusion in Baja California, because before the Immigration Act of 1924, the Japanese government refrained from sending Japanese immigrants to Mexico based on the gentleman's agreement signed between Japan and the United States. Because many Japanese immigrants in Mexico became undocumented immigrants into the United States. So the U.S. Wanted the Japanese government to stop sending immigrants to Mexico. And the Japanese government agreed with that policy. So there were not many Japanese newly coming immigrants in Mexico until 1924. But the 1924 Immigration Act unilaterally nullified the gentleman's agreement that prevented the Japanese government from sending immigrants to Mexico. So now the Japanese government became free to send immigrants to Mexico. So as a result, many Japanese migrated to Mexico after 1924. And many of them settled in Mexicali, Mexicali, Baja California. And the Japanese ethnic Japanese community developed in Mexicali. And another important thing is that the Japanese community in Mexicali, in Baja California, became a southern part of the larger Japanese ethnic Japanese, transborder ethnic Japanese community, with Los Angeles as its nucleus and center. So eventually, because of the 1924 Immigration Act, which was Japanese exclusion, it had an unintended consequence of creating a larger transborder ethnic community because of the newly coming immigrants to Mexico. And those Japanese immigrants in Mexicali are, you know, had cultural, political, and social relations, economic relations with Los Angeles Japanese. So when it's the creation of what I said, a transborder ethnic Japanese community. And what is interesting is that when Mexicans went on strike against Japanese farmers in Los Angeles, anti-Japanese sentiment developed and emerged with Mexican nationalism, and eventually affected the Japanese population in Mexicali, and putting pressure on Japanese in Mexicali to support Mexicans in Los Angeles. So because of that pressure, Japanese in Mexicali decided to issue a pro-labor, pro-Mexican statement and even donated $500, it's a big sum of money in that time, to strikers in Los Angeles, even though they had been supported by Japanese in Los Angeles, but they needed to show their support to Mexicans in Los Angeles. So that you know, strike in Los Angeles in 1930s cannot really understood within the framework of national history, U.S. national history, because it had impact in Mexico. And what is more fascinating is that that impact affected the Japanese government in Tokyo as well. So the people and the government officials in Tokyo were aware of the transborder development of the strike. So they tried to persuade the Japanese in Los Angeles that there was a growing problem in Mexico. So if Japanese in Los Angeles didn't make a compromise and agreed to sign some contract with Mexican strikers in Los Angeles, that would affect really problematic in Mexico. So finally, because of that transborder factor, Japanese in Los Angeles finally decided to make compromise and sign a contract with Mexican strikers in Los Angeles. So transborder, I'm talking about transborder ethnic Japanese community in chapter one, I guess. But that is a very important background to understand Los Angeles from a trans-Pacific and a transnational perspective. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really quite fascinating because you have these two kind of like geographic ideas working. I mean, you have, you know, this idea of these trans-Pacific communities, right, and connections over migrations, right, primarily through, you know, business relationships, political relationships that extend across family, migratory streams that extend across the Pacific, and then also just across the border. I mean, that example of how you have you know, Japanese businesses in Los Angeles that help support the Spanish language newspaper La Opinión, right? And then you have the businessmen, Japanese business owners in Baja California and in Mexicali that are worried, right, that due to the tensions over this strike, that there's going to be boycotts of their businesses and, you know, negative, discriminatory racial ramifications for them, which is what gets them, as you explained, to turn to actually support the Mexican strikers.
Yes.
You know, and yes, the consulates are involved and there's the international relations of it, of this. It really is such a fascinating example of all the complexity that exists, that goes beyond, as you explain in this particular chapter, an example of a triumph over ethnic, you know, nationalism or ethnic solidarity for a type of Mexican nationalism, right? The ethnic Japanese who are Mexican, right, in Mexico, supporting Mexican strikers. Tremendous example. I mean, just what a fascinating example, and how you interweave all these narratives is really great, particularly in that chapter. So yes, that's a phenomenal, I think, example of the complexity of this triracial hierarchy and how it, as you mentioned, it not only leads to these moments of conflict due to, right, the way that capitalist agriculture is run, particularly in Los Angeles, but it's also, you know, you have capitalism on the outside of the border is also, but you know, there is then also these moments of accommodation that exists between all different groups. So it's just not this maybe a you know, simple type of race relations. When we may think of a hierarchy, okay, we have the whites on top, we have the Mexicans the Japanese, as you explained, as the middle minority, and the Mexicans at the bottom. You know, due to all these different dynamics, it is very fluid, you know, particularly between the Mexican and Japanese, you know, as you mentioned, as they're both striving to essentially survive during very difficult times. I mean, this is happening during the Depression. So Japanese farm workers are tenant farmers are not making a lot of money. They're really struggling making a profit, right? It's very difficult for them, as you explained, to provide any type of a raise for Mexicans because they're barely surviving as it is. And then you have just situation thrown on top of it. So certainly fascinating. So you mentioned there's two strikes that you kind of cover in the middle portion of the book, and that really provide these different examples of how Japanese tenant farmers really have to rethink their relationship with their Mexican labor. The whole system, mind you, is dependent upon Mexican labor, that is agriculture, in that way, because as you mentioned, right, very clearly that's the primary labor source. Tell us about the role that, you know, internment plays. We move out of the Depression, and that's ended by World War II, right? The United States entering World War II for the most part. Then there's the complexity of, you know, the Japanese being interned. How does that shake everything up, both in for the landscape of Los Angeles agriculture itself, how that works, like economically, but then also race relations for Los Angeles in general.
Mm-hmm. So, are the Japanese internment, was a big impact in the situation of minorities and also the economy of Los Angeles. So, what I focused on in my book is that how California agriculture or Los Angeles agriculture could survive without Japanese farmers who played a significant role in maintaining and developing Los Angeles agriculture and California agriculture. So I was trying to, and at the same time, I was wondering if there was a linkage between Japanese internment and the Bracero program, because if you take Mexican American history classes, you definitely learn a lot about the Bracero program, right? And we study about the Japanese American history. We learn a lot about the Japanese internment, but those two big things are somehow discussed separately, even though those two events took place in the same year, I would say. So I was wondering how California agriculture could survive without Japanese, how Japanese internment was connected to Bracero program. So that's the starting point of my research. So when Japanese was removed and interned, there was a serious concern among agricultural officials of the agriculture department at the same time the California state government, and especially California governor Colbert Olson was very worried about the situation of agriculture in California, because he knew that Japanese were very important in agriculture. So basically what he wanted to do is keep Japanese within the border of California. So they, even if Japanese were under surveillance and under the control of the government after the Pearl Harbor attack, Governor Olson wanted to keep in some way the Japanese farmers within California to maintain or keep farmers operational. So the kind of he resisted to the mass removal and the replace relocation of Japanese outside the California or outside the farming area of California. So I looked at Colbert Olson's papers, and also I went to look at documents of the Department of Agriculture, and there are many evidence that officials kind of resisted the mass removal to keep Japanese. And it's not, the primary reason is to keep Japanese from an economic point of view, right? But if you look at those documents, you can tell much more than those economic factors. And Governor Olson really shows his trust in Japanese people, and he said things that those Japanese were, many Japanese were innocent, and there was no clear reason for many people of Japanese descent to be relocated. So he clearly said that kind of things in that time period, and I wanted to know how Japanese reacted to Olson's attitude. And basically, Japanese people, if you look at the Japanese newspapers, they are kind of welcomed. They reacted to Olson's attitude with favor. So I think I wanted to look at that point first. But eventually, Japanese was interned and disappeared from Los Angeles. So then, the same moment, the many Mexicans came to provide labor in Los Angeles. Although many Mexicans came to Los Angeles, but there was another problem, because Mexican workers who came through the Bracero programs were workers, not the tenant farmers. So there was a still serious problem of hiring the new tenant farmers who could take care of former Japanese farmers. And it was really difficult. And so I was looking at lease contracts of the Dominguez Hills area, and I was looking at who actually took over Japanese lands, and I eventually found many Japanese farms were first taken over by some non-Mexican people, but eventually they were taken over by Mexicans. And the president of one of the president of the land companies in Dominguez Hills said, actually Mexicans replaced Japanese in in his land. So the demographic changed dramatically. And the question is that when Japanese internment ended and many Japanese returned to Los Angeles, what happened? And after that, they reestablished the same triracial hierarchy or the same, you know, ethnic agriculture. But it was not the case because the World War II dramatically changed the industries in Los Angeles. So war industries and other and non-agricultural industry developed rapidly. And at the same time, so many immigrants, or it's a domestic migrants, came into the United States during the war and after the war. So that resulted in the rapid urbanization in Los Angeles. And many farmland became a residential or other lands. So there was no room for Japanese returnees to reestablish the same economic activities. So that's why that's, I think, one of the reasons why we don't remember well about the triracial hierarchy, because that kind of disappeared because of the World War II. So that's the drastic change of the demography and the impact on race relations in Los Angeles, I guess. Thank you.
Right. You know, particularly, you know, during those post-war years with urbanization, you get increased, segregated suburbs, the hardening of racial barriers, particularly for African-Americans in Los Angeles, the increasing Latino population. So certainly you're right. It's a complete demographic shift. Something that I'm interested in, just as I hear you talk, because I think of the time that we spent living in Los Angeles. If you go to farmers markets in Los Angeles to this day, I am particularly thinking of the farmers market that would travel through South Pasadena, which is where we lived, my family and I, while we were in LA for 7 years. Several of those farms are owned by Japanese farmers, or at least the stands are operated by Japanese farmers. So I presume that they're Japanese-owned businesses. I noticed that several of them were like either in Riverside or San Bernardino counties. Did any of your research show you that, you know, the Japanese families that perhaps were leasing lands and weren't able to come back and do that again in Los Angeles, did they move elsewhere? Did they go to other counties, whether it's, say, Riverside, San Bernardino, maybe even Orange County? And I know there were Japanese families in agriculture doing, you know, in Orange County, not to the extent that in Los Angeles, because Orange County was so dominated by citrus production, particularly Valencia's, and those were owned primarily by white landowners that did not lease their land out, at least to Japanese farmers. So anyway, so just to that aspect of it, was there kind of like another migration that sort of happened to other outlying areas?
That's a great question, because as I said, many Japanese returned to Los Angeles. So there were Japanese population, even though there was no triracial hierarchy that existed in the pre-war period. But, you know, many Japanese gave up stopped doing agriculture after the war. But at the same time, some of them wanted to keep doing agriculture because they are, they thought they were good at agriculture. So they wanted to use their skills, right? So many of them actually moved out of Los Angeles, for example, to Ventura County or Oxnard area. And there's still large Japanese farmers there. And also there are people who went to the Orange County, even though there were Japanese farmers in Orange County before the war, but they went to Orange County. So the center of Japanese agriculture certainly moved away to other areas. There's another dimension we have to look at. Even though Japanese immigrants stopped doing agriculture in Los Angeles, the gardening industry developed among Japanese very much after the war because of the urbanization. Now you have many houses in your city. You need to, you know, you need gardeners to, right? Make your house good or make your neighborhood good. So many Japanese became a major gardeners in Los Angeles. And interestingly, many Japanese hired Mexicans. Many Japanese gardeners hired in, you know, Mexicans in Los Angeles. So I wouldn't say that's a racial hierarchy because there's no, you know, white landowners in that system. It's Japanese gardeners were independent business owners. So they hired Mexicans. But still, the post-war period created a new race relations in Los Angeles because of the urbanization. So that's a fascinating part of
Wow. No, that certainly is. Well, Toku, I'm definitely appreciative of your time and, you know, for the time you spent with us on New Books on Latino Studies. And this will be, this conversation will be cross-posted on several other New Books channels and Asian American Studies and American Studies, etc. So we'll definitely get this out to a much wider audience. But just again, Toku, thank you for your phenomenal book. It was, it's even for someone alongside you that studied LA history quite a bit in grad school, I learned so much from this book that it was just very enjoyable. So thank you for this tremendous contribution.
Thank you so much for having me. And I really enjoyed our conversation. And I hope to see you in person sometime soon.